I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This podcast is brought to you by the supporters of patreon.com/DanLessac. And if you enjoy this podcast, you should consider becoming a supporter of patreon.com/DanLessac. This will not be the last time you hear the phrase patreon.com/DanLessac in this podcast. Enjoy!
Hello. Welcome back. It's January. January. I said I'd be back in January. I know I took a couple more weeks off than I said I would. Or did I even say it to you? I might have said it to myself and never actually said it to you. But hello, welcome back. This is Falling Forward episode 27 with me, your host. Yes, yes, I am your host, Dan Lessac. How are you doing? You can respond, guys. You know, you don't leave me hanging. Let's try that again. How are you doing? Come on. That's just rude. It's just rude of you not to respond. I'm doing well. I've got a bit of a sore shoulder. But that's a thing that happens. Apparently it's bad posture. I ended up going to the doctor's. It was like 2 weeks of horrible pain and weird crunchiness when I move it around. But yeah, apparently, bad posture. Stand up straight with your shoulders back and all that. So yeah, that's my life now. How's your life? Still no response, okay. I don't know what I've done to offend you, listeners, but I can take it. That's life. Who have we got on the episode this week, Dan? Thanks, Dan, for talking to me. It is Dr. Susie Gage. And the timing of this is almost like we planned it. She had a book out on Friday. That's just a few days ago. Called Say Why to Drugs. And if that name's familiar, that's because she also has the Say Why to Drugs podcast. On the Distraction Pieces network. What network's that, Dan? That's the network I'm on. This is like an inter-network collab crossover thing. Yeah, I know, it's very exciting. Anyway, I refuse to babble incoherently for another intro. That's New Year's resolution number one. Less incoherent babbling. Even though I am technically incoherently babbling as I say this, but it's a work in progress, guys. Come on. But yes, go buy Susie's book. It's available in like physical form, in paper form, from like Foils and the Waterstones, I think, and Borders. Is Borders still a thing? I think Borders is probably still a thing. You can get it at those places or probably the Amazon. Not the rainforest, the online store. And it's there's an audiobook as well, which there's a bit of me that thinks that maybe that's the best way to go. I don't know what the profit split on an audiobook is, though, so do the one that gives Susie the most money. But because she is a podcaster, she actually knows how to talk. I've heard her talk on her podcast and in person in this podcast. How many times can we say podcast? Yes, definitely babbling incoherently now. We are there. But yeah, go do that. And then listen to this and go, oh, that was an informative conversation between two people. Oh, and oh, yeah. Oh, yay. Patreons, thank you. We passed 50. We passed the 50 Patreons. That's the most Patreons we've ever had. And that might not sound a lot to some of you out there, some of you cynics, but 50 people chucking a dollar my way for a thing, this podcast, that's free, is kind of crazy. Like, I worry for them, but I also take their money and spend it on pizza and travel to the podcast. So I appreciate that. Thank you. And I think that's it. Yeah, no, let's just go ahead and have a listen to me and Dr. Susie Gage chatting about stuff, things, and other stuff. Enjoy.
The music on this podcast can be found at danlesac.bandcamp.com. And if you were to purchase some of the ambient twerks or trip-hop bangers from danlesac.bandcamp.com, you'd be directly supporting this podcast. Enjoy!
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Go for it.
I did it. I pressed that. Look at you in your snack corner as
Well, snacks that I'm not going to buy because they're probably obscenely expensive.
Probably very expensive. So we're in a hotel, listeners. And we're looking at the moment, if we wanted a chocolate bar, a Snickers, that's £2.
Whew.
£2 for a Snickers. Oh, a spirit, some sort of alcoholic beverage,
£8.50. Well, because I was going to put my sushi in the fridge, but I don't think the fridge is on, so it didn't feel cold when I opened the door.
Maybe you have to pay for that.
Pay for cold beverages, yeah.
I'd actually open this really loudly. This is all going
That's
in.
Foley, that
That's
is.
That's Foley. Is it still Foley if it is the sound thing that it's, of the thing?
Oh, yeah, I don't know.
Right, so who are you?
Hello, I'm Susie Gage.
Oh, you changed your voice slightly. We all do it.
Yeah. So, well, it's weird saying your own name.
It is.
Surprisingly weird.
My intro to the podcast is me saying my own name because it's in the title.
Yeah.
And feeling awkward about it.
Yeah.
And I think maybe 30% of the podcasts I've recorded, I've commented on how I don't like to.
I did
say
notice
my own name.
Your intros are quite sort of.
Verbose.
Apologetic about, yeah, saying your own
Anything.
Name.
They do. They're a little long. It depends because, like, you've just listened to the Luke Turner one, and that's definitely a longer one. Because I wanted to talk about that, how you support artists.
But it's really nice, I think, to have an intro to what you're going to be talking about to sort of set the scene. I think that's a good thing.
usually they're kind of less about what's coming up and more about, you know, a dog I saw.
Also interesting.
Also, yeah. But I rarely leave the house now, so I have no dogs to talk about.
Oh, just out the window dogs.
Just out the window dogs. I live in Reading, so they're drugs dogs.
Drugs.
Definitely drugs dogs.
Is this a very good segue that you're going
for?
No,
I could be a good segue, but I'm not going to use
too
it
soon,
that way.
Yeah.
I'm just going to talk about how Reading smells of weed the whole time now. I think it's because there is just a little gaggle of lads who smoke by a garage, just maybe 30 metres from my kitchen window. But they smoke the strongest smelling weed, like to the point where it's uncomfortable.
I grew up quite near Reading, but I haven't been back
so
to
where
Reading.
Where were you?
I grew up in Buckinghamshire, so near to Amersham,
okay.
High Wycombe kind of area.
Okay, Amersham.
Yeah.
So, you are, what, a psychologist?
Yep.
And how often do you get called a psychiatrist?
Not very often, actually.
Oh.
No.
That would have been funnier if it was often.
Well, so I'm also an epidemiologist, and lots of people think epidemiology is all about the skin. So
yeah,
that's something
like
I get
it.
A lot. But it's from epidemic rather than epidermis. So,
oh, okay.
So it's about the study of population health, looking at patterns in populations to understand health.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
But I've written down the word epidemiologist with a question mark saying that I should ask you what an epidemiologist
is. I've preempted you.
Well, no, it doesn't. This is a checklist
synergy,
of things. We can cross that off now. What's the deal with ranking of your job as well? You're an associate professor.
Yeah.
Do you have to do anything to become a full-on professor?
So I actually just got promoted. It's kind of a weird English-American difference in terminology. So I got promoted from lecturer to senior lecturer.
Okay.
But in some in the US and now in some institutions in the UK, but not actually Liverpool where I work, lecturer is called assistant professor and senior lecturer is called associate professor. So in some universities around the country, people on the same job as me are associate professors. In some, they're senior lecturers. But to become a professor, I'm not 100% sure, but you kind of apply for it and you have to have... there's a load of criteria that you have to meet.
So it's not like you kill a professor and...
take on their mantle.
You don't.
That would make academic life more interesting, but
sadly
not.
It wouldn't. You know, just... You know what?
There can only be one.
It's time.
/ 20 per department, yeah.
There can only be a limited number.
Yeah. I mean, that is true, and academia is kind of... It's one of those weird professions where people don't retire or seem to be less likely to retire than to sort of become some sort of emeritus professor and still be knocking around the department in their 70s or 80s even, rather than going reach 65 or, I mean, by the time this podcast goes out, it might be 75, who knows, but reach whatever age you retire and just go, see ya, bye. So it is a kind of thing where people do... stick around for like a sort of vocational
but I suppose,
kind of thing.
You know, you're meant to get better at your job the more knowledge you have, so I suppose it kind of makes sense.
Yeah, I think so, and I think it is something that you do because you're kind of passionate about it, and like, why would that suddenly stop when you reached a certain age?
Yeah. Oh, do you know what? I've wasted the last 45 years.
I don't care
life.
Anymore.
I'm going to start gardening. I should have been a gardening professor.
Yeah.
Horticulturalist. No. Yeah.
Probably,
kind of.
Yeah.
Kind of.
I don't know. Sorry.
Did you have a plan? Because you are an academic. It feels like a weird, not something you would get up in the morning at 13 and go, I'm going to be a psychologist. Like, how do you get from there to here?
Yeah, I definitely didn't have a plan. I think some people do have plans. Some people, I was speaking to someone who said since she was 5 she wanted to be a professor. She wanted to be an academic. She knew that was what she wanted to do, but I was definitely not.
She likes the holidays.
Now that is a big old misconception.
Yeah.
I'm afraid. Yeah, students get the holidays.
You don't.
Staff don't, because my job is teaching, but it's also research. So basically the summer holidays are when I get all of my research done because the students aren't there. But no, I didn't have a master plan or a strategy at that age. I think I wanted to be an astronaut. But given that I was, I mean, I've told this story a lot now, but given I was once seasick in a pedalo, I think space travel probably not for me.
There's no water in space.
Well, you know, but oh well, I've also been travel sick in a lift. Admittedly, that was after a transatlantic flight, which
but
I think...
Yeah, that's uppy-downy motion as well. So that's definitely on the flying into space thing.
I did actually, I met Helen Sharman last year, who was the first British person in space. And she, around the time when I was having this dream of being an astronaut, she was actually living that dream, going to space. And I said to her, I was like watching you and wanting to be an astronaut, and then I was seasick in a pedalo. And the look of sort of, she tried to disguise it. She was lovely, don't get me wrong, but there was a slight flicker of disdain that crossed her face. And I went, oh, yeah, you're right. But no, I didn't have a plan. I did an undergrad degree in psychology because I thought it was interesting. I moved up to London and went to UCL.
Undergrad
degree that.
Is just a degree.
BSc BA or one. BA, yeah. And at the end of it, I didn't really want to get a job. So I did a master's.
Which is post-grad.
Which is, the first level of post-grad.
So there's no grad in there. It's just under it or after it.
You graduate from your undergrad. And then for that brief moment, that is when you graduate. And everything beyond that is post having graduated from that first degree, I guess.
So what? But I'm a postgraduate podcaster right now. Because I'm after graduate.
But if you're studying it, you are postgraduate if you've graduated.
I feel like I'm studying it. Feel like I'm honing my craft.
I reckon. What was I saying? So I did...
Didn't want to get a job.
Yeah, so I did a master's, which was another year. I did all of that at UCL and I really enjoyed it. But at that point, even at that point, I didn't really realise that research could be a career. I thought, okay, so now I've got these degrees in psychology, I should probably become a sort of psychologist working in a hospital. Maybe I should think about doing clinical psychology. I didn't really think research PhD. I thought clinical. And then when my master's finished, I was in a band that I'd been in since school, and because all the rest of the band lived in Bristol, I moved to Bristol. And then had kind of a good few years of not really using my degree or not doing anything and not thinking.
Which is what Bristol's for.
Yeah, it was great. We did lots of music stuff. And I worked in some sort of temping jobs for a while. But then I did get a job at Bristol University doing research. And that was the first time I thought, oh, wow, this could actually be a career. And I could see people who've gone from research assistant jobs, gone to do PhDs, then become postdoctoral researchers, lecturers, professors, you know, that was a route that I could then see. This could be a career for life. And I thought, oh, great, so I'll start applying for PhDs. And I applied and I applied and I applied and I just didn't get anywhere at all. I think I applied 4 years in a row and that just couldn't get any funding to do it. So I was literally just about to give up. I thought, okay, this is obviously isn't working. I'll retrain. And I was thinking about becoming a secondary school teacher, maybe a biology teacher or something like that.
For the holidays.
For the holidays. I mean, I think there'll probably be teachers listening going, we don't get holidays
either.
Holidays.
We're just marking the whole time.
But, I decided to apply one more time, and that was the time when I got the PhD. And it's bizarre looking back on it now, because I very nearly didn't do any of this that's got me kind of where I am in this lovely hotel room
where
right
I
now.
Am today.
But you know what I mean? It's like the sliding doors moment where paths could have gone. In fact, they very
good
nearly
movie.
Went. Do you know what? I don't think I've ever actually seen it. But
I can't remember if it was any good, but I know I went to see it at the cinema.
I think the conceit is good, that the sort of a tiny change in timing, like one footstep different, and your life goes off on two different routes.
Yeah.
But yeah, I actually got offered a PhD, and then my supervisor was going to move to Lausanne in Switzerland. So I was all set to do that when I applied for another PhD in Bristol, and on a completely different topic actually. And then that was the PhD I ended up doing, the one in Bristol, which was looking at the links between cannabis and cigarette use and mental health. And it was kind of moving fields as well, because to that point I'd basically just done psychology stuff, but this was a PhD that was in an epidemiology unit.
Yeah.
And at the point at that time, I didn't really know what epidemiology was either.
Yeah. It's the skin, isn't it?
Yeah. So I thought, what's this got to do with the skin? So it was a bit, a big kind of lots of being in the right place at the right time and saying yes to things.
Mm.
But there was no master plan, and it very nearly didn't happen. And actually, I gave the graduate address to UCL student graduates last year, which was amazing and actually terrifying as well.
UCL, is that?
University College London. That's where London. I did my
degrees. I was trying to work out degrees. What the C was.
Yeah.
Because I was thinking University City London? That doesn't sound right.
Yeah, sorry. So it's, college. I don't know why.
Yeah.
But, and in that, I kind of, writing that talk about, they wanted me to talk about sort of how I got where I was, and I realised, it was just by being curious about things and kind of saying yes to opportunities and trying stuff out and not worrying too much. But I did. I was very close to giving up.
Yeah.
Because it is, there's something about academia that's quite tough and you need to have a thick skin for it. It's lots and lots of rejection. Mm. Rejection, you have to apply for funding, like research grant funding all the time.
Yeah, it's a weird one, isn't it? It's not like you're just sitting in a room thinking.
Yeah.
You know, you have to be at least thinking about something that more than one, that a group of people want you to be thinking about or looking into.
And it's really becoming quite metricized as well. You get judged on how much money you bring into the university and on how many papers you published, and impact is something really important. So you have to come up with the idea of the research that you want to do. Then you have to write a grant application to get funding from one of the funding bodies. So there are research councils that are government funded, but there are also sort of charities like Cancer Research UK fund a lot of scientific research, and the Wellcome Trust, kind of benevolent organisations like them, fund all sorts of really interesting things around biomedical research. And so you have to then write the application and justify why you want a certain amount of money to do this thing. And most grants that are put in are not funded. So you spend a lot of time writing things that are going to be rejected.
Yeah.
And then when you actually get the money and you do the research, you then write it up as a paper and you submit it to a journal and it gets rejected. And then so you submit it to another journal and it gets rejected. And it's quite
tough. Sounds great.
At times.
Sounds like a great job to do. Just get told, no, your idea's bad. Sorry.
Yeah, well, the most frustrating is when it's, your idea is great, but we don't have enough money to fund everything, and so we're not funding yours.
But I suppose, like, 150 years ago, you would have just had a rich patron to
I definitely think it's changed a lot. I mean, obviously, I haven't been doing it for that long, so I don't know what it was like, but speaking to people who are approaching the end of their careers, even they're saying it's changed since they started, and I think the sort of romantic turn of the century idea of academia is very much sitting in a room thinking and kind of and just going, I wonder whether that would work. And although actually, so having just written this book about drugs, a lot of the things in that a lot of the substances in that book, I wanted to write a bit about the history. And so many of the drugs, it was all someone who discovered it by testing it on themselves. And so I think that's a bit of a historical thing, as well as going, look, I've mixed these things together. Let's see what it does. Swallow it. And, I'm having a trip.
Wow. Yeah, this is great.
/ awful. Yeah.
Awful, yeah. Having to justify what you're interested in must be a really strange place to be.
I think it stifles creativity a little bit because, I mean, it's also sort of necessity as the mother of invention as well. So actually having constraints that you have to stick within can be really useful for that process. But also there are lots of questions that I think are interesting, but it would be very hard to find funding to answer them because they're not a priority at the moment.
Mm.
Although having said that, doing research into drugs and mental health, I'm quite lucky in that is a kind of public and policy interest at the moment.
Yeah.
So it is possible to get things like that are being funded.
And I think it's something that you can justify to your dad. Like, if your dad reads the Daily Mail, like, you can show him that, well, that guy on the street, I'm working out why he is on the street.
Yeah.
There.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's not, it's that thing with academia. Sometimes someone could be researching something that the majority of people will never have any, it won't touch their life in any way. So that then you feel like, well, why is that person getting money? And it's, well, it's still important. It's still important to
Well,
know.
Also, you need that kind of basic work to build onto the applied stuff as well. Mm. So if you don't understand the core concepts, then your applied stuff isn't going to work, or you're going to waste loads of money trying things that that aren't going to work, which you could have known if you did the sort of simple basic science research first.
Yeah, that's why architects need to know metallurgy and physics and all that before
they can
actually make their stupid looking building.
But I'm definitely lucky in the topic that I've sort of chosen or ended up researching, because it is something that people are interested in. It, people have an opinion about it. It's really easy to talk to people with no, you don't need to have any scientific understanding. You need to have an understanding of people, and we are all people, so anyone can talk about this subject.
Yeah, and literally, even if you've never, obviously there's no one who's never taken a drug, but of the fun drugs, what's it called?
Recreational? Yeah.
There
are no good terms for these things. No. It's something that people argue about still.
Even if you've not taken recreational drugs, you will have come across them through media or whatever, even EastEnders.
But it's very rare that no one's taken anything from sort of alcohol, coffee. Mm. You know, most people have at least had a cup of tea.
Yeah.
And most people in the UK certainly have had alcohol. And the illicit or illegal or however you want to call it, drugs use is less common. But most people don't have to go far away from themselves to know someone who's tried it you know, as you say, it's also in popular culture.
Mm. I only have to go about 30 metres over to their garage. It's not very far at all. I don't know, it's a strange thing with the way we are culturally at the moment, and, you know, the experts, who needs experts thing. It's a strange time.
Yeah.
Yet this work still needs to be done. We do need to understand why we are the way we are.
Well, if you look at sort of national statistics, we're in quite a worrying time, because substance use isn't really going up. In some cases, it's going down. But deaths from particularly illicit drugs, particularly things like heroin, but also cocaine, deaths are going up. And that's really, really worrying, because it's, use isn't particularly going up.
Mm.
But something about what the state of our country at the moment is making taking illicit drugs more dangerous, when actually we know more and more about ways to reduce harm. And maybe it's that there's this sort of ageing population of heroin users who have been using heroin for a long time and so have other health problems. Maybe it's austerity politics has closed a load of charities who do work with people who use drugs. There's lots of potential reasons about why this is happening, but we really need to understand it before it becomes even more of a crisis than it already is.
Yeah.
So let's get off my soapbox now.
She actually pulled out a box.
I know, hidden under the hotel bed, yeah.
It came in a flight case. I'm surprised you didn't hear opening the case. It's like, especially, it's a box you've been carrying around a long
time.
Yeah,
I've got a really bad back.
But how do you fight that anti-expert thing? How do you, like, you are an expert. You've spent years learning your subject, understanding vast amounts of research, to then have someone on the internet tell you, you're wrong, isn't you?
Yeah, and that's a really good question, and it's something that sort of people, science communicators or people who do public engagement, talk about all the time, of like, what's the best way to do this kind of work of talking about research in a way that isn't off-putting to people, or isn't patronising, or isn't exclusionary, and how do you do it where you're not just kind of preaching to the converted of people who are already engaged in this kind of thing, but who probably don't need to know really important information about risks from drug taking, or already know it. They're not the people who are the ones who are potentially going to die from doing a drug in a dangerous place or in a dangerous way, or more dangerous, you know. It's no drug use is without harm, and I include alcohol and tobacco in that as well. But it's, you say, like, I'm an expert, but I'm also a person. And it's the way that doctors are also patients, you know. We're not something separate from everyone else. We're part of the community that we live in, and we're part of the society that we are in, and that kind of thing. So that's, I try and be as human as possible in the work that I do, and bring voices that aren't just experts. So certainly with, when I started the Say Why to Drugs podcast, it was so amazing to have Pip involved, because it was immediately someone who's from a completely different world to me, in terms of sort of not a scientist, not someone who's, but not someone who's not an expert either, because someone who's got a lived experience, which is just as valuable as reading books.
Job in the Say Why to Drugs podcast is, if you watch CSI and they say, what are we going to test the DNA? His job is the guy who goes, DNA? So that the character has a reason to be explaining DNA again for the audience.
Yeah, but it works really well, because also he can talk about what he's heard about the drugs, and that can then lead to a conversation about sort of how we go about developing evidence, where it comes from, and also why some potential myths and misconceptions exist. But like you say, it's also, if I start saying something and I'm not doing it in a good enough way, then he's immediately there to go, wait, what? What are you talking about? And it's so helpful, because it makes me think about how I'm explaining stuff, and it just, it's a question that the person who's listening is thinking.
Yeah.
So it's essential that that is there, and so it's not just missed.
Yeah. And it's definitely nice that it's not just a, this one time I was on this, and then, you know, I was in the lift and I was feeling really nauseous. It's a really difficult thing to do, to talk about drugs without judgment, but without being the opposite end, that kind of
glamorization,
well, as like a cultural identity, you know, which is something I've always found interesting about drugs, how we, people wrap, they have a little bit of their own personality is that drug, like, especially weed has like a whole culture around it.
But also alcohol, I think, in a different way, but
because I don't drink, all I think about with alcohol is the look people give me when I say I don't drink.
But that's, so this is the thing that really gets me about the sort of hypocrisy that we have, certainly in this country and in lots of the rest of the Western world, for want of a better phrase, around drugs. There's sort of this feeling that taking drugs is a moral failing, or is somehow deviant, or, you know, there's like a moralisation around it. And yet, alcohol is so far the other way, that if you don't drink, people find it weird. And I think that is shifting slightly. Even in the last year, I feel like it's slowly, the tide is turning on that. But it's still,
it's a weird thing, because I think sometimes people think you're judging them by your decision.
Absolutely.
You know, I cut down my drink dramatically after I finished touring with Pip, and then just gradually winged it out. And I was with a friend for a curry the other day, and literally he was like, when he turned up my house, he brought beers, and I was like, sorry, man, I don't drink. And then, it was kind of this, we had a good 20 minutes of awkwardness over me not drinking. And it's like, it doesn't affect you.
Yeah.
It doesn't, it's not me saying you shouldn't.
Mm-hmm.
And you can still drink. I'm still going to be the same person. I'm not going to, my God.
I can't believe you're drinking.
You're drinking Cinzano.
I mean, you could judge someone for drinking Cinzano, but
I don't even know what it is. I just remembered the word. And I was glad it is actually an alcoholic beverage and not, like, paint stripper or something. But you could drink paint stripper. Don't. But you could.
It's not advisable.
If it's a liquid, you can drink it.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean you should drink it.
Yeah. But I think you're exactly right, and it's really interesting to hear sort of your experience of it, because I usually drink, but last year I gave up, or I stopped drinking, because I found myself getting into a, problematic relationship with it as I sort of developed anxiety, and I found myself
never putting the toilet seat down.
Yeah. Oh, I found myself drinking a lot, like most nights, to try and deal with anxiety. And because, like, I do research into the link between drugs and mental health, I sort of knew this is becoming an unhealthy relationship. And so I think I wrote something
about this.
So I stopped drinking, and it's not going to be forever, but for now I don't miss it at all. And the only annoying thing is occasionally people commenting on it, like you say. Although it hasn't happened as much as I thought, and possibly it's because partly the reason I stopped drinking is because I had anxiety because I had a miscarriage. And I think people, like, I've also spoke quite openly about it. I'm not sort of hiding it, or I'm happy to talk about it. Happy, maybe not the right word, but I'm fine to talk about it.
Chirpy about it.
And so I think people certainly who know me know that that happened, and so well, then it also then you can tell probably in the back of their heads they're going, oh, I wonder if that means she's pregnant again. And it's like, no, it doesn't mean that. It just means that I've stopped drinking for a bit. But I'm liking not drinking at the moment, and I think I probably will drink in the future, but right now it's great. And I feel like at the moment there's a lot of other nice things to drink. I've got really into kombucha.
Uh-huh.
It's really tasty. And loads and loads of alcohol-free beers.
The fermented one.
Fermented tea, yeah.
Yeah, Andrea drinks that. She's listening.
Excellent.
She'll
Hi,
be
Andrea.
The first person to listen, actually. She gets to listen to it before I edit it.
Nice.
She's the one who will tell me if you say something offensive.
Yeah.
I was like, what?
I didn't even realise.
Really? Oh, my God.
The urge to say something really offensive then. But
you're allowed.
I'm not.
I can. What I can do in the edit is turn it up and put like a big reverb on it, so it's like rah.
Yeah.
Instead of getting rid of it,
just amplify it,
accentuate
yeah.
it, and then we can edit in afterwards, like Ricky Gervais going, "Just a joke, brah," or something.
Yeah.
Because that gets you out of everything.
It's true. It was a joke, so it's fine to be offensive and unkind and cruel.
Yeah, whatever I do in my life, I'm just going to go with, it's just a joke.
Yeah.
You know, I might have pushed your mum on the train track, but it was just a joke, wasn't
just
it?
Just for some lols. You know? Shrug emoji.
Yeah.
I can't believe I just said shrug emoji. There you go, that's the embarrassing thing.
We should hire someone in. Everyone should have an emoji person. It would sort out any unemployment. You can employ someone, they just walk around with you. And then if you think shrug emoji, they can
just
do it.
Act it out. I mean, you could just act it out yourself.
Oh my God. What have you got against Bob having a job?
No, I'm happy for Bob to have a job. Sorry,
oh
Bob.
Oh my God.
Sad face and crying
Bob.
Emoji.
You'd be here helping you right now.
Thanks,
or
Bob.
Or Bobette, Bobina, I don't know.
Bobby.
Roberta.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's fine. We'll leave that in. That's gold.
Good.
So, I think we started with, like, how did you end up here? And clearly you had no plan or
no.
anything. But that's how it always happens,
yeah.
isn't it?
I think so. It's definitely how my life has happened so far. Like, I never had a plan to do a podcast with Scroobius Pip, but that happened. And I always wanted to write a book, but I never actually thought I'd be able to do it. And my book...
You write all the time because you write for The
Well, that's
Guardian
it. I never thought I was going to write for The Guardian either. So when I started doing my PhD, I thought, at the end of this, I'm going to have to write a PhD thesis, which is like 80,000 words or what have you. Maybe less. Probably less. Mine wasn't, but that was a mistake. And I thought, well, I need to practice writing then. So I start writing a blog. So I just started doing it with a couple of friends who were also doing PhDs. And we just put it up ourselves on like a WordPress site, and kind of it had maybe 10 or 15 people reading each post and what have you. The people I picked to be blog buddies were a bad choice because they were in their final year of their PhD, so they very quickly realised that actually they need to be getting on with writing their actual PhD and not a silly blog that no one reads. So they stopped and I kind of inherited it. And then... as a bit of a punt, I entered it into this science writing competition, and it won. And some of the judges were people who worked for The Guardian, and at the time they had a science blog network of scientists and researchers writing on the Guardian website, and they asked me to pitch the book to them, so I did. But this all kind of happened within the space of about 6 months. So where I started my blog to practice writing, suddenly I was writing on a website of a national newspaper, and it was terrifying. And this kind of the same thing happened with the podcast as well, is that I had this idea to make this podcast quite a while ago, and I recorded a couple of interviews with scientists where I kind of interviewed them about drugs, and I didn't know what I was doing in terms of recording or in terms of interviewing. And interviewing is difficult. And I think I just thought, oh, you just ask people questions, it's fine. But there's a bit more to it than that. Who knew?
It's all editing.
Yeah, it's all in the edit. And so I've got these really dry, echoey, rubbish recordings. Mm. And then I kind of sat on the idea for a couple of years, and it was only a chance meeting with Pip.
Well, yeah, because I went back and listened to that one. I'd listened to it at the time, but yeah, it was because that you only came up because he was going to be in Bristol.
Yeah,
I think it was. Yeah, randomly,
he asked on Twitter for people to suggest people on the podcast, and someone suggested Huey Morgan, and someone suggested me, and Huey was busy.
Yeah.
So you know, things could have been very different. Imagine Huey Morgan and Scroobius Pip's Say Why to Drugs podcast. It'd be amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
Probably be better. Damn it. Yeah. Sorry, world, you got me instead.
Sorry, guys. But you're like, what, a million downloads now?
Yeah, over a million. But that even that, like, I thought this would be a good thing, and I thought I wanted it to be useful and used, but I wasn't expecting it to be in the top 10 of the iTunes chart the week it launched.
Yeah.
And that, I was not prepared
that
for
was
that.
It top was top 10 of the actual chart.
The
not the what we, me and Stu do, is like whittle down to the category, whichever one of the categories that makes us look the highest. Oh yeah, I'm number 7 in arts.
Yeah, I've already started looking at my book on the Amazon charts, and there are so many weirdly specific Amazon charts. I think at one point I was at number 11 in lifestyle and addiction pharmacology, which is like the most specific chart.
That's very specific.
It's just me and David Nutt, basically. And I'm still only at number 11.
But he's got 10 books.
Yeah. God damn it. But yeah, things sort of ran away with themselves, and there were things that I was just kind of trying out, and suddenly I was in a position where it's like, oh God, I've really got to make this good. I can't just try stuff out and hope and see what sticks. I've got to. But having listened back to the first few ones, it's definitely got better, the podcast, as it's gone along, and I've learned so much doing it, and I'm still really proud of those first episodes. And still, the cannabis one, which was the first one we put out, is still the most listened to one. And I think people do, because it's not, I mean, research has changed, so that was 3.5, maybe nearly 4 years ago now, that first episode. So obviously a lot of research into cannabis has happened in the last 4 years, and legalization has changed around the world. You know, I really need to do an update of that. But for the most part, it's not a kind of time critical thing. So I think people, when they listen, they do go back or pick a drug that they're interested in, or a drug that they have never heard of. Like, there's lots of different ways you can approach it, but you don't need to do it in order, and you don't need to... you can listen to one that was recorded 4 years ago and still get important, useful, hopefully interesting information out of it as well.
Well, hopefully some of the drugs we've got a good grounding on by this point. But obviously, like you say, there's, with the way legalisation is happening in the States with cannabis, I think we're going to see a hell of a lot more research because of the fact that...
Yeah, it's possible to do it.
Far more mainstream now.
And you can do sort of better quality research. Although, to be fair, a lot of the research to look at the long-term effects of a substance, you still can't do an experiment in the same way that if you want to look at intoxication, you can give people a substance and research... like, take data from them while they're intoxicated.
Yeah.
But if you want to look at, like, does long-term cannabis use cause schizophrenia? You can't take a group of teenagers and randomly assign half of them to use cannabis for the next 5 years and half of them not to, for multiple reasons. But, I mean, it would be...
Yeah, I feel like there's laws.
Yeah. I mean, I sit on an ethics committee, and I think we'd have problems with that.
Yeah.
But even if you could get ethics for it, it would be A, incredibly expensive. It would take an incredibly long time to do because your study would be running for years and years and years. Mm. And how would you get people to adhere to their condition for 5 years? You know, mm-hmm. 5 years of not doing something or doing something. Like, people would just drop out. So the way we do this kind of research, and this is what observational epidemiology is you look at, you follow up people over time and look at what they choose to do and see whether that affects their later mental health or physical yeah. health or what have you. And that kind of study design was how we discovered that smoking caused lung cancer. But it is really hard to get at causing something, because the people who choose to use cannabis are different from the people who choose not to in lots of ways other than just their cannabis use. They might also use other drugs, or they might have different friendship groups, or, you know, all sorts of things might impact a person's choice to use cannabis.
Well, this is like this idea that, oh, well, cannabis is a gateway drug to harder drugs. It's like, well, maybe, but maybe also you're going to
exactly.
a drug dealer.
Exactly, yeah, exactly.
You know, McDonald's is the gateway to
other obesity
burgers.
Or,
yeah. Yeah, like, because I'm already going to that place. Of yeah. course I'm going to get the fiery nuggets.
Yeah, and a know. Big sugary milkshake or what have you, yeah.
Mmm,
yummy.
I didn't miss the milkshakes. Quite a bit.
Yeah, sorry.
It's the only thing. Oh, hot apple pies. Get right, guys. You know about this, guys. Banana milkshake, hot apple pie, dunk.
I must admit, I don't think I've been to a McDonald's since I was about 12.
Now you have a reason to
before
go.
Before we went to watch Wickham Wanderers, we'd go and get a McDonald's.
So before the McFlurry, they used to just have Mr. Whippy in their ice cream, and you could buy it. This is a legit thing. They would put an apple pie in a tray thing and put ice cream on it.
Okay, that sounds good. Get,
if we go back far enough, let me take you back 24 years to West Thurrock Retail Park
yes.
McDonald's, not Lakeside, and you could get yourself a little 7-inch McDonald's pizza.
What?
In either just margarita or pepperoni. Yes.
Wow. What went wrong?
I know. They had a pizza oven and everything. I know that because I worked there at 16 years old.
Wow.
I used to work. I wasn't allowed to work past 10 o'clock because I was only 16.
Because you were only a little one.
I would regularly work past 10 o'clock.
Naughty.
Ronald McDonald is a slave driver. And sometimes, like, I just did because there was a nice girl who'd give me a lift home.
Nice.
She was a lot older than me, though. Like, she was like 19.
What? Ancient.
I know. That's 16. 19-year-olds are ancient.
They're a different world. Yeah.
Intimidating.
That was a sidetrack.
This is what it's all about. That's what life's all about. Mm-hmm. We've said about that. We've said about that. We've said about that. We've kind of said about that. So, you mentioned in when you were on Pips about a double bass. Why is there a double bass?
Oh, that's not mine. So there's a double bass that's in my house. There was a double bass in my house in Bristol. Was there a double bass?
Is that
in my
a
house?
Different double bass?
Yeah, I think it is. It belongs to my friend Tamsin.
Okay.
Who is a climate scientist and all-round mega person.
But she's got a double bass. That's a lot of wood she's wasted.
Yeah. I think it's quite an old double bass.
She should be playing the violin.
It was a second hand when she bought it, so...
Oh, good. No, that's fine,
it's,
then.
It's
that's
allowed.
Fine. So what was the band?
So I was in a band, but I didn't play the double bass in it.
That's such a shame.
I play synths and sing. In fact, I've been in lots of bands. So when I was at school in sixth form, I joined a band with some boys from the boys' school. Yeah. And
your mum was not happy.
She was more happy about that band than the band I was in before with some boys from 2 years older in the boys' school. She was not happy about that band. That's another story that we're not going to talk about on the podcast. But
your mum is an avid listener. She
yeah,
does.
She will be listening. I mean, if I put it on Facebook, she almost certainly will listen. So, hi, mum. I don't mind her listening. Mostly, that's fine. in sixth form, we started this band. Well, they were already going, and I saw them at the school talent show.
Mm.
And they had their name in that talent show was Two Headed Sex Beats, which was a Chris Morris reference.
Yeah.
And their singer left or something happened anyway, and I met up with one of them on the way to a Trail of Dead gig in London on the train, and he's like, oh, do you want to join the band? I was like, yes, please, thank you, please. So I went round to their house with my not very glamorous sort of keyboard, like, budget model just for kind of playing the piano on. But because I could play Light My Fire by The Doors, I was allowed in the band. And we started off just doing covers. First ever gig was supporting Lindisfarne.
Nice.
Actually, maybe that was our second gig. Our first gig was at a friend's party, and they had a party in a barn. And so all the boys all dressed in drag, and we played as Susie and the Barn Shees.
Oh, nice.
Very good.
Nice.
Very good. Then we became The Shades, which
The Shades
was an amazing name. And that was when we were doing covers. So we played this gig with Lindisfarne, which was also in a barn. Early gigs, very much in barn-related music. And we also played the Holmer Green Village Fete.
Nice.
As The Shades, which had a brilliant moment where we finished a song, and over the PA it came a, we interrupt The Shades to announce that everything on the bric-a-brac stall is now 50 pence.
Oh.
And now back to the music.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it was truly, we were living the dream. But Wickham, High Wickham had a really great venue called The White Horse.
Mm.
And it was a strip club during the day and a gig venue during the night.
Daytime strip clubs aren't great.
Well, I didn't go during the day, to be honest.
You should have. You should have, so we could have a conversation now. If you'd gone, experienced.
Well, so I don't know whether, I mean, sometimes I wonder whether I dreamed this, but on Channel 4, there was a kind of musical documentary about sex workers. I think it was called Porn the Musical, where sex workers sang about their life as a sex worker. In the late 90s, early 2000s, it must have been. But a lot of that was filmed in the green room of the White Horse. I was like, so I was watching it. I think it was at university, so maybe it was between 2001 and 2004. And I was like, oh, I've been in that room. And that got me some looks. but yeah, so that we played some really great gigs. And then we all went off to different unis, but not too far away. So I went to London, our bass player went to Southampton, drummer to Exeter, and guitarist went to Bristol.
Mm.
And the guitarist was studying medicine, so his degree was longer than everyone else's. So as we all finished our degrees, we just gradually moved to Bristol. But while we were at uni, we tended to play one gig in each of those places per term.
Mm.
And then over the summer, we would do lots of gigs. And so I never did any of the kind of travelling, because we were always touring. So one summer during uni, we went up to Scotland and did a little mini tour.
Yeah.
Brian, our guitarist, had family up there, so we stayed with his aunt and uncle. God, those poor people. Just, like, played music all day and messed about and then went, like, played the Drithy Duck in Inverness and things like that. It was brilliant, but, yeah, it was very kind. And, our family all very kind, letting us sort of practice in their houses and that kind of thing. My parents' border collie, by the end of her life, was completely deaf, and I do think it's because she had a bit of a crush on the drummer in my band, and she used to just sit by his drum kit while he was playing and stare at him. She recognised his car when it drove around the corner to our house. She would get mega excited, more than for anyone else. Yeah.
Maybe he had a scent.
I think it was because she did sometimes try and hump his legs.
She-humping.
Well, yeah, and also she'd been neutered as well, so I think it was just a confused love. But yeah, it was great. It was the best of times. And then when we all moved to Bristol, we signed to this amazing Bristol record label called Sink and Stove, and we did quite a lot of gigs. But so we did a couple of years of really
intense
doing it, putting out records, and we supported some quite cool people, and then it all kind of fell apart because these things do. And our guitarist, who was by that point a medic, was obviously really busy and went to New Zealand for a while to do some stuff. And it just if we wanted to do it, I think we probably would have all had to say, right, we're gonna quit our jobs for this year and kind of go for it. It just wasn't the right time or place to do it.
See, that's the thing, though, isn't it? It sounds like most of you were all doing quite vocational things, whether you realised at the time
Yeah, well, I wasn't at the time. I was working as a secretary in the NHS, and it was awful. But
I can imagine.
We also all lived in a house together, like the monkeys.
Nice.
It was great. But Bristol was such a great place to be. In fact, I was also listening to your episode with Andy Hung, and one of my favourite gigs we ever did was with... So, Rosie Plain, who's now pretty famous. Safety Word, who are probably the best Bristol band, sadly now departed. Us, and then opened by Fuck Buttons, an unheard of band called Fuck Buttons. Where are they now?
Me and Pip always get it as well. I was like, do you remember that time Adele opened? Like, we did one with, it was us, Jack Pignatti headlining us, and then Adele opening, and it's like, that's weird.
Yeah.
We've of the, like, rad, huge female pop stars, I think Florence and the Machine's been on before us. Adele.
Kate Bush, yeah.
Kate Bush. No, Kate Nash.
Kate Nash.
But we have been on before Kate Nash, but never on... She never had to support us, lucky girl. It's weird. It's, like, really weird. I think we were, like... If you got to support us, you got really big.
Yeah. Nice.
That's not true.
Kingmakers. Or queenmakers,
only
maybe.
Only for women, yeah. We're sexist. Like, the good version of sex. Is there a good version of sexist?
Misandry is supposed to be the opposite of misogyny.
So, that's pro-woman?
Well, more sort of anti-man. I don't think there's pro-anything. Yeah.
So not like...
As feminist.
I've heard of that. We kind of... I think we're good. Is there anything you...
Well, I could talk more about the book if you want
Yes, that's what I needed to ask. Like, so... What is it like to have done all this work, all this research, and now to finally be, like, putting it physically? It's right there, like, a physical thing in the world.
It's weird. Writing blogs was always quite kind of nerve-wracking. Putting something up on the internet that then was going to have its own life and there was nothing I could do about it. Was quite nerve-wracking. It never stopped being nerve-wracking, really.
Mm.
Because particularly when I was writing about things like plain packaging of cigarettes, and there are people with very strong opinions about that. And also I've written lots about e-cigarettes, and there are people with very strong opinions about that as well. And people can take your words and twist them. And the first post I ever wrote about plain packaging of cigarettes was... still on the blog, before The Guardian, and no one was really reading it. And I tweeted about it, and Cancer Research UK retweeted it. And not long after that, I went to a debate about plain packaging in Bristol, where Philip Morris Tobacco is based. And after the debate, a woman came up to me and started talking, and then I was there with quite a lot of people I work with. And she went, oh, I know who you lot are. You're the Tobacco and Alcohol Research Group. Which one of you is Susie Gage? And she worked for Philip Morris and had heard my name. And I was like, well, that's really weird. And, like, just a bit, not, I don't know, it just put me slightly, just was confusing, really. And then when I got home that night, I also discovered that a libertarian blogger had written a whole blog about me and why, because I like knitting, I couldn't understand sort of economic policy or, you know, all of these kind of things, and kept referring to me as kiddo. And I was like, at the time, I think I was 32. So I was like, yeah, thanks, mate. Kiddo, great.
But that, is that, like, I suppose if they have to go down that route of trying to undermine the person rather than...
That's exactly it. After the initial sort of shock, I was really relieved because they hadn't argued with my argument. They'd done these ad hominem attacks on me, or not attacks even, but just kind of trying to belittle me as a person. It's like, well, if you can't respond to what I've written and you're just responding to me as a person, then... fine, like, that's good.
Yeah.
Because the thing that I really worry about with all of this stuff around drugs, so the podcast and now the book as well, is because it's an area where there's so much misinformation and it's really hard to find good quality evidence-based information about drugs. Like, everything I wrote in the book is available online, but to find it all and put it all together was really tough. And the thing I'm just terrified about is adding more misinformation, sort of unintentionally getting something wrong or misphrasing something so it's unclear, and creating more problems, you know. And because it's an area where people have a lot of opinions about it, and also lots of the people who use drugs know far more, or certainly illicit drugs, know far more about the effects of those drugs and also a lot about kind of the science as well than researchers, because researchers are quite often playing catch up, particularly when you're thinking about novel psychoactive substances and things like that, where the people are using them for a while before scientists or researchers even realise they exist, potentially. So they know about they know what these substances do, they know like the chemical formulations, they know how to make them and that kind of thing. And so that's quite far away from the science that I know about. I know lots about sort of looking at population health and understanding risk and things like that. But thinking about that kind of thing, and also I've written quite a lot about the history, and I'm not a historian, and I'm really conscious that there's a lot of like medical and science historians who get really frustrated with scientists kind of steamrolling into their field and in the beginning of their book going, this is what happened in the past, and like, because history is definitely one thing and not at all exactly the same as science. That you, it's the same thing of being built on evidence, and some evidence is better than others for what happened in the past, and who writes the history is really important as to how you interpret it, as to where, like how true it is. There's not really truth and proof in science, in history, the same way there's not really truth and proof in science, because it's all about like varying levels of evidence. So I'm in that weird, like the book is coming out in like a week and a half,
so it'll probably just
probably will be out by the time this comes out, maybe.
So
by then I'll probably know, like it might have had reviews or that kind of thing, but at the moment very few people have read it who don't have to be nice about it because they're in some way related to me or they're involved they're involved in publishing it. So it's really, I really don't know whether it's any good or not. Like, I'm really proud of it, and I feel like I've done the best job that I could do of it. But it's perfectly possible that everyone could hate it.
Well, someone, they've gone to the effort of physically making it.
Yeah.
You know, so somebody thinks it's good enough to be something that will be here potentially. Yeah,
a publisher is going to put it in bookshops.
Yeah. It's going to, like, there'll be libraries that buy it.
But you know what I mean?
Do libraries still exist?
Please. Yeah. Always libraries. I love libraries. But I think it's just entirely sort of paranoia and the culmination of having written it. And now
and there's
this,
no edit button.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is the second edition. And the good thing is if I do spot typos and things, the Kindle version and the ebook can be updated straight away, and then the second edition, the paperback when it comes out and that kind of thing, they can all be changed. But for they've printed, I mean that's a proof copy there, but the hardback has also now been printed. I've got copies of it at home.
How many have they printed?
I don't know, that's the thing. I don't know, it probably does actually say in my contract, but
you know what, when the first album was done, we didn't know how many they'd done.
Yeah.
But I actually don't think we ever know. Like, it's really weird. You're kind of like, do this.
Yeah.
Put this out in the world for me. And then, like, there's this group of people who go off and do it. It's really weird when you've made something that capitalism values.
Yeah, but it's a weird time when it's done, it's finished, and that it's been a long time getting to that point. So I met my literary agent the day after the Brexit vote happened. And that's when the idea of the book first started. And then we wrote a proposal, we put it to publishers. We got a deal, I started writing it, I sent the first draft, it came back.
Because it's science writing, you don't have to write it in advance.
Yeah, I got...
Depends what you're trying to write.
A deal for... so the proposal had... I think I wrote two or three chapters and the introduction and a kind of brief. So it was the proposal was sort of 20,000 words, but it wasn't the whole book, So then I wrote the book, and then then suddenly, like, things kind of happen in fits and starts, so suddenly you've got the copy edit and you need to get it back within 2 days, and then you get the proof and you need to check that, and then... And then you've got to go and record the audiobook, and then it all goes quiet again for a bit. And then suddenly it's like, oh, the books have all arrived, and you've got to start thinking about interviews, and you have to start talking to a publicist, and that's terrifying and brilliant as well. And now I'm in the weird time where it's nothing's probably going to happen for the next couple of weeks, and then suddenly it's going to be out in the real world, and I'm going to know what people think of it. And I just want to know now. It's the sort of uncertainty of, I'm sure it is all going to be fine, because, and lots of really amazing people, researchers and friends and lovely, kind people have read loads of the chapters in it and given me brilliant, really helpful feedback on it. And without them, I'd be really terrified right now. But it's a weird, uncertain time right now.
The hardest bit I find with any sort of release is the getting over my own, like, ickiness about self-promotion.
Yeah.
The buy my thing.
Yeah.
Thing. Especially now, even with, okay, you're going to have some support from your publisher and all that, but even now, you still have to say it.
Yeah. And I think regularly it's much as well. Easier now because of sort of social media, but also maybe that devalues it because everyone can be a bit of a self-publicist on Twitter and what have you.
Well, so what I think using Pip as a gauge. So if you've posted more about your thing than Pip has posted about,
then you're probably
his stuff,
doing a bit too
then
much.
You're doing too much.
Yeah.
He seems to have just got a nice level, and he varies up the way he promotes it as well.
He's
different photos.
Exceptional at it though.
He's very good at it. Yeah.
But that's a real skill.
He got really good at it after we stopped working together, weirdly.
Yeah, well, I mean, you guys didn't do badly in terms of sort of famousness and success from an outsider perspective, anyway.
Yeah. That's
by the by.
there's a kettle of worms.
Fair enough.
There.
A hornet's nest.
A can of fish and whatever right there that, you know.
Fair enough.
But, like, definitely, like, self-promotion is one of the weirdest things it is new.
Yeah.
I think if this was 30 years ago, what was that? That's the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't really have the internet then. You know, you generally, like, if this was 1990, you would make this book and then it's the publisher.
Yeah, they would do all of that.
They're the ones advertising. They're the ones getting you written about. They're the ones. That's it. That's how. It's really. We're the first generation that's really had this. I say first generation. We're the first era that's really had this drive that we have to self-promote.
Yeah, well, and an avenue to be able to do it, I guess.
But that avenue, not only to be able to self-promote, but to actually do it. Like,
yeah.
Do the thing that gets
Yeah.
Like, you wouldn't. The BBC weren't going to pay you 30 years ago to make 20-minute programmes about recreational drugs. You know, like, we've got this opportunity, the new media, free media, whatever you want to call it, to...
Yeah, we can create...
Make this thing.
Yeah, everyone can publish, everyone can make music in their bedrooms. You know, that's what everyone said when I was a teenager. It's like, oh yeah, like, the 90s is when everyone can make music in their bedrooms, and, you know, like... White Town is always the first thing that pops into my head when I think about that.
BBC Basic. He made that on a BBC Basic.
And it's brilliant.
It's very good.
But, yeah, like, all of the stuff this is also weird because it's the first time I have had a publicist working with me, doing loads to promote the book. And everything else I've ever done, like the podcast and everything, I mean, maybe Pip counts as a publicist, but, you know, everything else, I've just sort of shouted about it myself and asked other people to shout about it. And so this is also weird that it's taken some of that pressure off but added a different kind of pressure, because suddenly it's like, oh my god, there's other people's sort of have taken a risk on this as well, whereas everything else I've done has just been me going, well, I'll see whether this works, whereas this, like, I've been given a book deal to do it. You know, a company has spent not a small amount of money to make this book happen, and they're relying on it recouping, or, you know, they're like, they believe in it, so it's not just me I'm letting down, I guess, is what I'm thinking. Not that I think I've let anyone down, I hope. Definitely paranoid at the moment.
I find it funny because, like, I had a solo album with Sunday Best and then the Dan and Pip albums. And the Dan and Pip albums recouped. Mm-hmm. But my solo album's, like, well in the hole. Like, I don't know, 17 grand or something still. And we're coming up to 10 years after it came out. 8 years. And it is really odd. But I like to just balance it out and just think, well, yeah, that might still be in the hole. But this over here has more than made up for that. It's fine.
Yeah.
It's fine. So you've just got to think, whoever the biggest writer on your publisher is...
Yeah, they're making enough money for the rest of us.
They're funding any shortfall in your work.
I mean, that is true, because that's how these kind of things work, isn't it?
Madonna funded some of the greatest indie bands of all time just by being...
Mega successful.
Mega successful.
Yeah, yeah. That's a very nice way to think about it. And it's good that that is still happening because that's how you get the interesting stuff. Mm. It's not going to sell a million copies, but it is going to be doing something different. And for people who don't want to read Madonna, listen to Madonna. I've got my analogies mixed up, but
yeah, Madonna's science writing has really dropped.
I would read 100% read Madonna's really science writing off. Book.
So, what's the book called?
The book is very originally called "Say Why to Drugs."
Okay, what's the podcast called?
The podcast is also called "Say Why to Drugs."
Wow,
I didn't come up with that name.
Do you not
name.
Think that's going to get confused?
Well.
People are going to be trying to download the book.
I mean, you can download the book, so that's an extra confusion. I mean, download the audio book and then you can be really confused.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. The audio book is...
pulled a nubbin off my earphones.
Yeah. The audio book is... I think there's quite a few people who listen to the podcast who are quite excited about the audio book. They're like, oh my God, it's going to be like a 10-hour, 12-hour podcast.
Have you abridged it for the recording?
No.
Nope. Oh, right. Good.
It's in full...
I don't like abridged. I feel like they've cut out something good.
Yeah, it's difficult because there are lots of things like footnotes, so trying to work out where to put them in. And also in the book, there's lots of myths.
Do you just do those in an accent?
I should have done. Well, what I tried to pitch was that it would be great, because Pip's written the foreword, so he's going to read the foreword, which I think is going to be awesome. But I was saying, well, why don't we get him, because like lots of... each chapter is made up of lots of question headings, and then and it would be great if he asked the questions, and they thought it would be too disruptive, which I see as well. It would be quite jarring, maybe, if every
like
often.
With the footnotes. Like, let me just interrupt you for a second.
The way Adam Buxton does with his fact checking Santa, just I mean, so I've read the audio. Well, I'm actually going to finish it off tomorrow, but I've read most of the audiobook, and I'm going to read it all myself. Which is really fun. I went into a fun studio, and Bill Nighy and Pete Perfidus were also in reading their books.
Nice.
Or I don't know whether Bill Nighy was reading his book or someone else's.
Somebody else's.
But it felt very
glamorous.
He wasn't
even being paid. He just turned up just doing a bit of reading. He can only read out loud. He can't read in his head.
No, so he just might. I might as well let you record it while I read this book.
So. Yeah. So you know, like Prince had a music video made of every song he ever wrote, which he did.
And he wrote like a stupid amount of songs.
Yeah, like Kevin Smith directed videos, but like these are all locked in a vault somewhere. Well, Bill Nighy does it. He reads every book he's ever read, he's read out loud and has recorded.
Yeah.
Yeah. So sometimes he'll go back, you know.
But it's
even when he just stops, he gets bored of a book halfway through, just in case.
Just
you know, he got half of a recording that Dostoevsky's The Idiot.
Yeah.
But he never got through it. Oh, it's all the Russian. It's really hard to keep track of all the Russian names.
Yeah, it's hard to pronounce them. You have to keep,
I couldn't get... I really find it hard to read Dostoevsky. So I deliberately just change their names to English names.
Huh?
And it's fine. I can remember who that person is.
You can buy books where they reprint them for you, but with your name in it. So I've got a version of Wuthering Heights that my friend got me with like my name and her name and other people's names in it instead of the characters.
Put it in as Dr. Susie Gage.
Just the whole way through.
The whole way through.
Yeah. But yeah, doing an audiobook's weird. I like had a really amazing editor who... So I think different companies who record audiobooks do it in different ways, but they... If you stumble over a word, or you know you miss something out, or you pronounce something in a weird way, they edit it on the fly. Mm. So rather than then someone having to take a 12-hour file and chop out all the times where you went, oh, sorry, can I say that again? They do it as they go on.
Yeah.
So it's to begin with, it's incredibly weird because they keep stopping you and then replaying a bit of your voice and then the recording cuts out and you have to carry on.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to find your place in the text and scroll up on the iPad and blah, blah, blah. But once you get into the flow of it, it's really well. It works really well. And yeah.
It's funny because you might find it changes how you record your podcast intros and stuff. You might find that it's easier to edit yourself.
Yeah, although I don't tend to record on a computer. Mm. I tend to record on a handheld device.
Oh, I know. So, but what I mean is you start to realise how your pitch changes and stuff.
Yeah.
And how to give yourself the flow. Opportunity to...
I think, though, I'm getting better at that. Anyway, just from doing the podcast for so long, because I edit the podcast all myself as well.
Yeah.
At the beginning, I had someone doing it for me, like very kindly sort of volunteered after they heard the first one. They went, do you want someone to do some editing for you? I was like, oh, okay.
So, because this is quite natural.
Yeah.
I do hesitation editing.
Yeah.
So if I need, say, when we talked about bands, I'm probably going to cut that down a little.
Yeah.
That a little bit more succinct. But what I'll do is, instead of trying to edit it in such a way that it's smooth and all that, I'll use an or an and make it appear like you...
Just had a thought and drifted off somewhere else kind of thing.
Somewhere else. And I really like doing it, because I do make myself sound like I'm just completely skittish sometimes. I'll be like talking about one thing and then just suddenly... Or I like to make the person interrupt me,
which
is probably dishonest at this point. It makes them look bad. But every now and again, it will sound like that person's just, I've started saying something and they've just ploughed over me. And you're like, but it works perfectly.
But that is how conversations work.
Mm.
Like, people don't talk really neatly and then when they finish, the next person starts.
Yeah.
That's not how people talk. And you can tell when things have been edited like that because they sound unnatural.
I hate it. Like, with some podcasts, when they just ask the question and they've got the next question, and it's just, interesting.
Mm.
So, and it's like, come on.
Were you actually listening?
Yeah. Were you,
is it my turn to talk now? Yeah.
Well, that's it. I think we've got it done. You've plugged the book.
Yeah.
You've plugged the podcast.
Thank you.
Anything else?
I mean, no, I'll be doing lots of stuff, but I don't know when it is yet. Book festivals and things, but I don't think I can announce them yet, so...
You'll probably be at Hay.
Not Hay yet, but other ones. I'm hoping Hay, but I think they're booking now and they haven't got in touch yet.
They might, though.
They might.
You never know.
Some good ones. Glasgow, which is called Irate, which is the best name for a book festival ever. A book festival in Glasgow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, wouldn't work anywhere else.
In Surrey.
Yeah.
Like, what?
Yeah.
I'm hanging up. Bye, listeners.
Bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi.
Well, did you enjoy that conversation? If so, smash that subscribe button and drop a scintillating 5-star review. And don't forget, you can support this podcast directly by hopping over to patreon.com/DanLaSac. Enjoy!
Well, well, well. There we go. We're back. First one of the new year. What a goodie. Super conversational. We just had a natter. I like the nattering. I'm going to try to do more nattering and less overthinking in the podcast. I know it's all meant to be very deep and meaningful, but I'm sorry, I'm fiddling with the guitar pedal while I talk. And it's probably making a noise. But yeah, no, I liked it. I enjoyed it. Susie's lovely, and the podcast is really good. Having taken chemicals in my life, allegedly, it's kind of interesting to me to hear what I've done to my body in a non-judgmental manner. So yeah, allegedly, not the judgmental, you know what I mean. You know what I mean. Next week, the other one, in a fortnight, we're back with a internet person who plays video games on the internet and talks about video games and plays video games. Did I say play video games? Yes, a Twitch streamer and YouTube content creator around the video games. So look forward to that. Anything else? Give me money on danlasac.bandcamp.com and I will give you other things in return, i.e. music or merchandise. Rate, comment and subscribe, obviously. That's the thing you're meant to do. On anything. No, it doesn't even have to be my stuff. Just go somewhere, rate it, comment and subscribe to it. And I'll see you in like 2 weeks. I'm actually going to record the intro to the one in 2 weeks, like in maybe like five minutes. So it's going to be a bit weird. I'm going to be pretending that we're in the future. I tell you what, if you've listened this far, I'm going to say, oh, the response to last week's was amazing on faith. I don't know how the response is going to be. I'm recording this in, you know, the future. So yeah. So when I say that, on the next one, know that I'm lying. And only you people who listen to the end, only you special few, know that I'm a big fat liar. Anyway, talk to you soon. Bye!